Welcome back, everybody. It's Russ here with another episode of the New Yorker Political Scene. On the last episode, my dad and I responded to the New Yorker Political Scene's episode on the Republican National Convention. And between when their episode came out and when me and my dad recorded our episode, we learned that Joe Biden had dropped out of the race. For those of you who aren't regular listeners of the New Yorker's Political Scene, they've actually put out two episodes of their show. They did an emergency episode on the news that Joe Biden was stepping down from the 2024 race. And then a few days after that, they put out their regular episode, which was mostly about Kamala Harris, her candidacy, and the search for her vice presidential nominee. Now, on this podcast, in the last episode, me and my dad did talk about Joe Biden dropping out of the race. So I'm going to go a little light on that material from the New Yorker's Political Scene podcast. But I did want to play one clip, which is a back and forth between Susan Glasser and Evan Osnos. Osnos, of course, has become the New Yorker's de facto Bidenologist.
Evan.
Yeah.
This is first and foremost a political story, but it's also a personal story. And I think many people were gripped by, you know, the drama and pathos of President Biden, age 81 years old, seeking to hold on to this office that he spent his entire adult life seeking to gain. He gets it, and then it's his own party leadership that pushes him out. What do you think in the end was decisive for him? I mean, there were so many, as Gene, you know, said in our conversation before the show, you know, there were so many ups and downs, so many moments when we weren't sure if he would bow to this pressure campaign. Why did he in the end?
So this gets at the heart of one of the things that's emerging as a sort of thesis statement of this podcast that I'm doing. And it's the way that these three on the New Yorker's Political Scene and a lot of other journalists and analysts in American media understand politics not as the arena through which we adjudicate different disputes and move the government and its policies in one direction or another, and how people's needs and desires can be addressed through government, but rather they understand politics as an ever-unfolding mythology and an endless cast of characters. Those characters, of course, are the politicians, not the people who the politicians govern over. And in that paradigm, we as citizens are really more like spectators. We cheer for our favorite character because their success brings us joy, not because of what it means to us in material terms, but because it's gratifying when the good guys win, and it's sad when the good guys lose.
You know, the thing that has always been interesting to me about Joe Biden, frankly, is the psychological layering of this person, because that's in some ways what sets him apart from these other political figures. Look, there's a lot of people who have had ambitions and have also made their way to the top in one form or another. And what's interesting about him is that he has always sort of teetered and oscillated between these moments of failure and setback and humbling and then surging forward.
I think what makes my point even more effective here is an article that Evan Osnos wrote in the New Yorker the day that Joe Biden announced he would be dropping out. The headline to that article is Joe Biden's Act of Selflessness. Subhead, throughout his political career, the president has turned pain into purpose. Now he must do it again, by Evan Osnos. Quote, even amid the immediate political calculations, it was impossible not to reflect on the sheer drama of Biden's about face this weekend, just as Republicans wrapped their convention. He has made the rarest of choices in this desiccated, demoralized politics of our time. He has sacrificed his own ambition for the sake of the country. Of course, he only quote-unquote sacrificed that ambition after it was clear that his entire party was standing against him. Polling data reflected that he was underwater in all of the swing states, and the Democratic Party's biggest donors came to him and said that they were pulling the plug. But sure, why not frame it as a valiant act of self-sacrifice? Skipping ahead to the final paragraph of Osnos' article, in his letter to the nation, Biden included a short passage on his record. Quote, we've protected and preserved our democracy, he wrote. In fact, that matter is decidedly unsettled. But in stepping out of the race, he took one more step to protect the system to which he has devoted his life. All I have to say about that paragraph is, citations needed. The idea that Biden has devoted his life to protecting the American system of democracy and not to his own personal ambition, again, is straight out of the Evan Osnos Biden hagiography playbook. But I think if you look at his career and you look at his life and the decisions he's made while trying to pursue power and while in power, you might find a good number of counterexamples to that assertion. Okay, so that was all from the New Yorker Political Scene's emergency episode on Joe Biden dropping out of the 2024 election. We're going to move along now to the most recent episode of the New Yorker's Political Scene, where they talked about the emergence of Kamala Harris as the Democratic frontrunner, which, as the host of the Political Scene pointed out, came just ahead of Benjamin Netanyahu's visit to Washington, his speech in Congress, and then the private meetings he had with President Biden, Kamala Harris, and then Donald Trump. And in their discussion, they analyzed the way that now candidate Harris dealt with Netanyahu's visit.
Remarkable that Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu happened to be in town in this week that turned out to be the very first week of the Harris for President campaign. And I watched last night, fascinating kind of semiotics of the world turning, if you will, right? You had President Biden having one bilateral meeting with Netanyahu, and then later, Vice President Harris having her own. She's conducting, in effect, her own diplomacy with Netanyahu. And how interesting, Biden never came out and talked after his meeting, but Harris did come out and talk. And so I thought this was really fascinating.
That is fascinating, Susan. Speak on it.
If you diagrammed what she said, you couldn't find a specific break with Biden's policy of support for Israel while at the same time pushing on humanitarian issues. And yet the kind of surround sound of it was extremely different.
Okay, so in terms of substance and policies that might reduce the suffering of Palestinians, no real change between Biden and Harris. When it comes to vibes,
the implication is that Harris has stressed much more the Palestinian plight. She was quite adamant. I thought she did a very good job of threading the needle. She didn't back away from American support for Israel, but her emphasis was very different. She said something so interesting. She said, "I will not be silent about this." And I think what she's trying to do is essentially signal to the Democratic base, I'm going to have a different emphasis on the Middle East and in particular on Israel than Biden. I'm not going to radically shift our policy, but that may be enough messaging.
Of course, when she says that might be enough messaging, she means enough messaging to get enough votes to win the election, not enough messaging to get Israel to stop its genocide in Gaza.
And by the way, it does comport with my own reporting from inside the administration that since October 7th, Harris has been at one end of the spectrum inside the White House at those meetings in the Situation Room, that she actually has been internally as well as externally much more focused on the humanitarian crisis and on, you know, getting to a sustainable place for the Palestinians compared to some of the other White House advisors.
So earlier in that clip, Susan Glasser calls the political theater around Netanyahu's visit semiotics, which I think is such a perfect choice of words. Semiotics is an area of philosophical inquiry that examines signs or the visual representative meaning of things. And as she goes on to point out, there is as of yet zero daylight between Biden and Harris when it comes to their Israel policies. The difference is a purely aesthetic one. Harris, as Glasser reports, shows more concern for the suffering of the Palestinians, just like how Osnos helps in the construction of the legend of Joe Biden. Here, Glasser is doing the same thing, echoing the reporting that in behind-closed-door meetings, Harris does seem to be very concerned with the plight of the Palestinians. Of course, it is all just semiotics or political theater, unless Harris is at some point willing to break with what has been the Biden administration's policy when it comes to Israel. But that, of course, is not what the New Yorker political scene is concerned with. They are concerned with electoral politics and how all of this might impact Harris's ability to win the presidential election. That's pretty much the only lens through which they examine the impact of policy. They're not interested in how these policies affect people in the United States or in Gaza, but rather on how they affect the heroes of their stories, people like Joe Biden and Kamala Harris.
The chair of the House Progressive Caucus, Pramila Jayapal, said this week that she'd talked to Harris and concluded that she has, as she put it, deep empathy for Palestinian Americans.
I don't know if that's just a slip up of words there. We should all have sympathy for Palestinian Americans, but the people we should all be concerned with are Palestinians in Palestine. They're the ones being killed in large part because of the U.S.'s support for Israel.
It's interesting that, as you say, Susan, in some ways, the letter of the law, the things that she's saying are not substantially different. But it reflects this broader political impact of this transformation at the top of the ticket, because just the sheer change from Joe Biden to Kamala Harris has given, even within the caucus, an opportunity for people to revise their position.
It is also interesting, though, that, I mean, she has a certain amount of protection against charges of being an anti-Semite because she happens to be married to a Jewish husband.
Although Trump already attacked her, which is classic. Anyway.
So I think what they're referring to there is that Donald Trump has said he doesn't understand how Jewish people would support Kamala Harris. And he also recently seemed to agree with a radio host who called Doug Emhoff, Kamala Harris's husband, a crappy Jew. What's funny to me is the notion that caring about Palestinians would somehow make you anti-Semitic just goes completely unexamined by the host of the political scene. We don't have time on this show to completely unpack how anti-Semitism is being weaponized these days to smear anyone who speaks up against Israel. But Harris herself described anti-Netanyahu protests in Washington last week as anti-Semitic, despite the fact that many of those protesting were in fact Jewish and included family members of hostages, as well as family members of people who were killed by Hamas on October 7th. I'm reading now from the statement put out by Kamala Harris in response to the protests against Benjamin Netanyahu as he addressed Congress. Quote, "Yesterday at Union Station in Washington, D.C., we saw despicable acts by unpatriotic protesters and dangerous hate-fueled rhetoric. I condemn any individuals associating with the brutal terrorist organization Hamas, which has vowed to annihilate the State of Israel and kill Jews. Pro-Hamas graffiti and rhetoric is abhorrent, and we must not tolerate it in our nation. I support the right to peacefully protest, but let's be clear, anti-Semitism, hate, and violence of any kind have no place in our nation." Nowhere in that statement does she mention understanding why people are rightfully upset that Benjamin Netanyahu is speaking to Congress, or that the United States is supporting a genocide that's happening in Palestine, nor does it nod to any legitimate protests that were being done that day. Instead, one might deduce that Harris basically thinks that all of the protests were anti-Semitic and therefore illegitimate. So the idea that she's somehow sympathetic to Palestinians, none of that made its way into this statement.
I think that, you know, this is going to be a theme that we return to in the next 100 days again and again, this question of how much is Harris able to own the positive parts of the administration's record without being saddled with the same attack. So we don't know yet the answer, but it's been very interesting, I think, to have this first test on Gaza this week.
So I know that there are those among us on the left who are hopeful that Kamala Harris actually represents a change in terms of what's happening with the genocide in Gaza. And some of them are arguing that Harris's hands are currently tied because even though she is running for president, she's still serving as the vice president to Joe Biden. And so she's not able to step out of line and contradict the administration on its policies. If I was serving in the Biden administration, I simply would not defend a genocide. That's what I would do. I try to not cross picket lines or support genocides if I can help it. Call me nitpicky if you want, but I guess that's why I'm not vice president.
I think Susan's absolutely right that there can be very awkward sort of dynamics in this relationship. And polling shows, apparently, that one of the more difficult things to traverse for her is why she didn't let on earlier, or why she may have misled the public about the extent to which he was impaired. That's a complicated question for her to know how to handle publicly.
I actually totally agree that this is going to be a complicated issue for Harris to deal with going forward, and it's definitely something that the Republicans are going to attack her on, and honestly, rightfully so. Harris, if we all remember, the night of the debate was on CNN defending Biden's mental acuity to Anderson Cooper.
some within your own party are wondering if President Biden should even step aside. What do you say to that?
Listen, first of all, what we saw tonight is the president making a very clear contrast with Donald Trump on all of the issues that matter to the American people. Yes, there was a slow start, but it was a strong finish.
She poo-pooed calls for him to step down and concerns over his age and his mental state. Frankly, she participated in the ruse that Biden was okay and fit not only to run for office again in 2024, but to continue to be the president for the next 6 months. I'm not sure how she plans to explain all of that, but I do think it's important to remember that in 2020, in the Democratic primary, one of her biggest weaknesses was the perception that she was inauthentic and that it was unclear where she stood on certain issues. And whether or not voters knew all the details, I think generally being wishy-washy is something that people pick up on. And so I do think this is going to be a major challenge to her to go to the American people and to ask them to invest in your credibility when you're one of the people that was defending Joe Biden and his mental acuity in the final days before he announced he was giving up on his reelection campaign. So now they get into a discussion about who Kamala Harris might pick as her vice presidential nominee.
A lot of people who have looked very favorably at Shapiro. He is obviously, I've heard him described as a generational political talent. And I will say, I came out of the Republican convention last week in Milwaukee with one word, Pennsylvania, 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 top of mind. That is what the Trump campaign believes is the decisive state in many ways in this election. So in a way, that would be a safe choice. However, you know, this is a country. Is it really, forget about, you know, a woman at the top of the ticket, a woman and a Jewish candidate? That's something that I think causes an incredible amount of anxiety.
So does Susan Glasser suppose that having a Jewish vice presidential nominee would be a liability to the Democratic ticket? And if she does think that, who does she assume would take issue with it? Is it conservative voters or swing voters, or is it voters on the left who are opposed to Israel's war on Gaza and for one reason or another link Israel's war on Gaza to being Jewish? I have a theory. I think Glasser is intentionally blurring legitimate criticism of Israel with anti-Semitism. Let's see if she mentions Shapiro's position on Israel's war in Gaza.
For those of us who know how deep the wellsprings of bias and discrimination run in this country, it's a little bit scary.
I just say one thing about that, though, which is, you know, we've had a Jewish vice presidential candidate in Joe Lieberman.
And they didn't win.
They didn't win, but I've never seen anything that said it cost them any votes.
If we weren't in this incredibly divisive political debate over the war between Israel and Gaza, maybe that wouldn't be the case. But I do worry that right now it's become activated. You've seen anti-Semitism and anti-Semitic incidents in this country at historic levels. So clearly, there are a lot of people who are motivated by this right now in our society.
Aha! So it does seem that Susan Glasser is saying here that picking Josh Shapiro as Kamala Harris's vice presidential nominee could be a risky choice because there are so many people who are upset about Israel's war in Gaza, and she links people being upset about the genocide in Gaza with anti-Semitism. What's curious, though, is she never mentions Josh Shapiro's stance on Israel's war in Gaza, which I would argue is the actual liability to picking Shapiro as a running mate. I'm reading now from a Salon.com article by Jeff Cohen and Norman Solomon. The headline is, "Picking Josh Shapiro could be dangerous for Harris. Here's why." In 2021, after Ben & Jerry's refused to sell its products in Israel's illegal settlements, Shapiro, who was then Pennsylvania's attorney general, threatened the company by urging state agencies to enforce a constitutionally suspect law targeting advocates of boycott, divest, and sanctions, or BDS, against Israel over its discriminatory policies. Shapiro smeared such advocates by claiming that, quote, BDS is rooted in anti-Semitism, although the effort has wide support globally, including from many Jews, as a thoroughly nonviolent tactic aimed at advancing Palestinian rights. After the horrific Hamas attack of last October 7th, several dozen Pennsylvania-based Muslim groups wrote a letter protesting Governor Shapiro's one-sided comments, quote, "Not only did you fail to recognize the structural root causes of the conflict, You chose to intentionally ignore the civilian loss of life in Gaza. Responding to the letter after Israeli bombs and missiles had killed more civilians in Gaza than had been killed by Hamas in Israel on October 7th, the governor's spokesman said, quote, "We all must speak with moral clarity and support Israel's right to defend itself." Skipping down here, beginning in late April, Shapir and his office repeatedly prodded campuses to, quote, "restore order and take action against student protest movements, such as Penn's Gaza Solidarity Encampment, which called on the college administration to provide greater transparency on university investments, divest from Israel, and reinstate the banned student group, Penn Students Against the Occupation. On May 9th, Shapiro invoked student, quote, safety in demanding the encampment be shut down. Police shut it down the next day, arresting 33 people. In two different interviews, Shapiro seemed to compare campus ceasefire activists, many of whom are Jewish or students of color, to, quote, white supremacists camped out and yelling racial slurs, and, quote, people dressed up in KKK outfits or KKK regalia making comments about people who are African American. So what Glasser tries to depict as latent anti-Semitism in America that would make putting a Jewish vice presidential nominee on the Democratic ticket a liability is more accurately described as a liability because of Josh Shapiro's track record of defending Israel even when they're egregiously in the wrong. Now, I know there's also talk of Arizona Senator Mark Kelly as a possible running mate for Harris. I think ultimately Kelly is going to have the same issue as Shapiro. There were reporters covering Netanyahu's speech in Congress last week. One of them was Akbar Shahid Ahmed, who writes for the Huffington Post. He tweeted during Netanyahu's address, "Mark Kelly claps for Netanyahu, saying protesters may be, quote, Iran's useful idiots." And Prem Thakur, who's a reporter for Zateo News, noted, "While many Democrats have refused to applaud for Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, possible VP contender Senator Mark Kelly has quietly applauded with his hands lower." So will any of this matter in November? I honestly don't know. The conventional wisdom is people don't vote on Israel, including most Jews. This year could be different because of the war in Gaza. But I do think if Democrats are trying to appeal to young people this year, they would be wise to pick a running mate for Harris that does not outflank her to the right when it comes to Israel. So that's all I have for you this week. Thanks again for joining me. Now here's a message from our very own Evan Osnos.
If you've been enjoying the show, please leave us a rating and a review on the podcast platform of your choice. And while you're there, don't forget to hit the follow button so you never miss an episode. Thank you so much for listening.